We wrapped up another busy week of coronavirus coverage on Connecticut Today on Friday, April 24th. We spoke to a local nursing professor about the challenges that many state nursing homes are facing during the COVID-19 virus outbreak. Aaron Johnson, our sports guy, joined us to talk about the NFL draft. What did he think of the picks? And we talked about the fact that that was the first major sporting event in weeks to give people a little bit of a diversion. Governor Ned Lamont chimed in with his daily coronavirus update. We spoke to a gentleman in the 5 o'clock hour who's trying to implore people and companies to manufacture and buy American. The state's nursing homes are having a lot of them, having a rough go of it during this COVID-19 outbreak. And people are wondering, are those nursing homes that house, you know, many of our mothers, fathers, as they get old, grandmothers, grandfathers, you know, all manner of relatives. What can they do to keep folks in there safe? And if there are diagnosed cases of COVID-19 in those homes, is the procedure proper? Joining us right now is an associate professor of nursing at Quinnipiac University in Hamden to chat about this, Sheila Maloney. Professor Paul here at WICC. How are you? Thanks for joining us.
Yes, hello, Paul. Thank you so much for having me.
Did you anticipate that we were going to possibly have a problem like we are having, at least at some of the nursing homes in this state, with the COVID-19 outbreak? Was this inevitable?
I think it was very likely. I mean, if you think about flu outbreaks, anywhere where we have people that are living together in close proximity to one another, certainly, it is likely that a virus might spread between those people, whether it's in a college dormitory or whether it's in a nursing home.
And obviously, Professor, simply the layout of nursing homes, no matter how new some of these facilities might be, no matter how modern they might be, getting away from the old style of basically a glorified dormitory, it's still a problem, is it not?
It's definitely going to be a problem. And also, if you consider the types of care that is needed and that is delivered, one of the reasons why individuals are living in nursing homes is because they need some help with personal care, with direct care. And that involves staff members coming in and out of the room to assist with that. And so there's going to be a lot of close-up personal contact. And that's why protecting staff members is helping them to stay healthy is equally important in these nursing home settings. And also the older adults who are living there or younger adults with disabilities that are living there may have other types of health conditions that make it more likely that they will have an infection.
We deal, Professor, with the flu virus on an annual basis. It mutates the way it does. We've dealt with MERS in the fact we've in the past we've dealt with SARS, which are varieties of the coronavirus. The books, quote unquote, that are already in place, the rules, the protocols for situations like that. Did any of those prove or are any of those proving useful in this situation in nursing homes? Or is this a real curveball that we're getting thrown at here with COVID-19?
I think that we're still learning more about this particular coronavirus. And one of the most challenging things that we are beginning to learn is that there are probably more people that have the virus, that are infected with it, who are asymptomatic. They're not really showing any signs or symptoms. And yet they may be sharing that infection with others before they even know that they're sick. So I think that's why this call for universal testing, for more available testing, is so very important, because we need to be able to identify individuals who do have the virus, even if they're not yet showing symptoms. And we need to be able to use some of the knowledge that we already have about how to use personal protective equipment appropriately in order to protect people who are not infected.
Generally, are staffers who work in the modern-day nursing homes, Professor Maloney, are they trained properly in the use of PPE and also basic virus and bacteria prevention of spreading? Or is that something that's kind of that kind of goes in the refresher course category every so often?
I think all nursing home staff receive training in basic infection control procedures. Certainly, we emphasize hand hygiene and hand washing because that's one of the most effective practices. And everyone receives at least some basic training in the use of personal protective equipment because that type of equipment is often used for other types of infections as well. I think the difference with this situation that we're in now is that in the past, the use of personal protective equipment might only be for one or two people. But in this case, we need to put it on and take it off in between every single person, hopefully. Or the other difference is that the N95 masks, the special fit test respirator masks, those have not been widely used before outside of hospital settings. Those are usually used for not frequently for other types of infections, for example, for tuberculosis. And so that might be something that staff have not had as much training with. And we also haven't had as much experience with this much of a widespread outbreak all at once. So I think we really need the expertise of our colleagues who are infection control experts, infection preventionists, to really come in and support and help these nursing homes, to retrain people, to increase the availability of infection control materials and protective equipment, to give a little bit of a refresher. You know, even myself as a nurse who's quite familiar with how to put on the protective equipment and how to take it off, it has to be done very, very carefully, and it has to be done correctly to prevent infection. So I think that re-education, support, and definitely the expertise of our infection control practitioners is very important.
And we are joined for a few more minutes talking about the nursing home situation in the state amid the COVID-19 outbreak with Sheila Maloney. She's an associate professor of nursing at Quinnipiac University. Professor, what were your thoughts when you saw what the state was doing, how they're handling this early on when they said, okay, there are going to be some COVID-19 positive homes and COVID-19 negative homes? And I know from having both my parents in nursing homes at one time and relatives too, moving around people, especially the elderly in certain stages of frailty, is not always an easy or recommended thing. What do you think of this whole positive, negative home setup?
Yeah, I think that's a very important issue. I think that it is helpful to have some homes that are dedicated to caring for individuals when they come out of the hospital as a post-acute care setting, because those individuals might need a more intensive level of care, maybe not hospital level of care, but maybe something more than what the nursing home could absorb at that time. So I think that that's a reasonable approach for post-acute care. As you mentioned, transferring someone from their home, from their residence, can be very traumatic and can be harmful. So that would be a step that would only be taken under extreme circumstances where someone was really at risk. I think the principle of trying to assess individuals that live in the nursing home, try to cohort people together who have infection and keep folks who are not yet infected apart, that's a very important infection control strategy, and that's why we need the appropriate and comprehensive testing in nursing homes to allow some of that to occur. Some other states have taken some interesting steps that I think that we might think about here in Connecticut. In Maryland, they have some strike teams going in to support nursing homes who request the assistance. And the strike teams are providing some of that initial assessment, triage, and then helping if folks have decided that they want to receive intensive acute care and they have the infection and it's appropriate, they're being transferred to the nursing home. For individuals who have made the decision that they don't want extraordinary measures, then they're allowed to be cared for in place using our best expertise in terms of comfort care. And in these settings, the strike teams include clinical personnel, non-clinical personnel, and other types of support people and National Guard, members of the National Guard. And they're providing temporary staffing support. so that if the nursing home is affected and staff members are affected, they have that support.
Finally, Professor, the notion of visitors, you know, we all feel we have the right to see our mom or our dad or grandma or grandpa whenever we want. And it's sad, but, you know, clinically necessary that, you know, those rights be altered at a time like this. And it's obviously heart-wrenching to read about these stories where you and I have read the cases of families having to say goodbye to a loved one in a nursing home from, you know, behind a glass or not even be able to be led in the room for a final kiss or a hug goodbye.
Yes. I mean, I think that at the time of end of life, I think that family members and chaplains should be considered essential personnel. And I think that we should help facilitate visitation at the end of life for family members and for chaplains, making sure they have access to adequate protective equipment so that they're not putting themselves and others at risk as well. But I think that providing care for family members at the end of life is they need physical care, spiritual care, and emotional support. And having family visitation and clergy visitation at end of life can actually be a support for the staff in nursing homes as well. And also we have hospice and palliative care nurses that could help provide comfort care packs and do other things that improve dignity and comfort at end of life. So I think that's an area that hasn't yet received enough attention.
I would assume, Professor, finally, that after we get beyond this, maybe as soon as next year or the year after, there will be portions of nursing textbooks that will be written or rewritten about this episode.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think that what we learn from this should help us to prepare for the next wave or the next emergency. And in fact, some of the places that are doing best with this are those that began their preparations with the H1N1 outbreak several years ago. So I think we need to continue to learn, and we need to keep our values and the priority to give the most humanistic, effective care that we can.
Associate Professor of Nursing at Quinnipiac University, Professor Sheila Maloney. Professor, thank you. We appreciate the time. Thanks, and be good.
Thank you so much for having me, Paul.
Thanks, Professor. Appreciate it. Well, for the first time, probably in two months since the first week of March, so we're almost at maybe 7 weeks, we had something major in sports last night. Now, it looked a little different, but we had the NFL draft, to which a lot of guys, and probably some women too, probably were thrilled to have because it's a diversion. It's something to talk about in the realm of stuff that is supposed to be a diversion, sports. It's supposed to make us feel better and forget about what's going on for the time being, if that is at all possible. Our old buddy, our old producer here, sports maven of the program, now produces Hannah and Raven on Star 99.9, was among the millions of young men like me, I'm not young, but we share the same gender, I believe, who was stapled to the multiple video images coming out of Roger Goodell's basement last night. Aaron Johnson's with us. Aaron, how are you?
I am good, Paul. Thanks for having me on again. And in the infinite words of Ricky Bobby, thanks, sweet baby Jesus, that we had the NFL draft last night. I needed something.
Yeah, because every time you and I talk during the week, it's radio that we love, and food, and that's it. I mean, there's literally nothing else going on.
And this was something that, and I was glued to. I had the NFL Network on my Xbox, on my television. I had the draft on my phone. I had the ticker going on my computer. So
jeez.
I was locked in like you wouldn't believe.
And your wonderful girlfriend, honey, do you have to watch it all places? Did that come up last night, or did she leave you alone?
No, it definitely came up because I told her earlier in the day that the draft is going to, you know, start at 8 o'clock, and that we've been doing Netflix party, watching movies and stuff while we're doing the social distancing. And I told her, I was like, you know, we could start the movie probably around, like, I said, I mean, 9:30, 10 o'clock. The Jets are going to be drafting at 11. She said the Jets are drafting at 11 p.m. I said, no, 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 no. So it was fun. We were able to work it out, but she let me watch the draft. I watched a lot of it, and I had some thoughts on a lot of different picks, and I think that it was a great way to kind of give an opportunity to people to have a little bit of normalcy back, give them an opportunity to watch sports and have something that, you know, it's not all doom and gloom. It's not all what's going on with the COVID-19 virus, but it was sports. It was something that, you know, you're sitting at ESPN, you're watching it, you're enjoying it for the first time in a long time. And so it was definitely needed, I have to say.
And I like the fact that, because, of course, you two aren't married yet, but there was kind of a negotiation thing. It's okay, we could do this because the Jets aren't picking till that. In about 10 years, if you're married, Aaron, that's going to segue into, listen, I'm watching the draft. Leave me alone for 2 hours. That's it.
I learned from the best, Paul. You taught me well while I was there. I'll say that.
All right, we'll get into the nitty-gritty of who took whom, what are the Patriots doing, the Jets and the Giants, all of that with our sports buddy Aaron Johnson straight ahead. We're talking a little sports here. We do that now on Fridays, and it was important because last night the NFL draft, the first real nationwide sporting event to really kind of give people a little bit of a kind of a breather here, a needed breather in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic. And the NFL did it right, going out of its way several times in the procedure there, even though it was all done remotely, to recognize the brave efforts being put out by first responders, medical personnel, and also to help raise money as well. Okay, our buddies here, Aaron Johnson, former producer of the program, now produces Anna and Raven on Star 99.9. Okay, Aaron, the Mekhi Becton, the guy the Jets took, this is a mountain of a man. You watch the video of him in college. And Aaron, and I know you covered some of these games that we talked about when you worked for the newspapers as I did. He looks like that big kid that was oversized in Pop Warner, that is like 6'8 when he's 12. But you look at him, right? You look at him on video, and he's holding off full-size guys with like one hand. This guy is a mountain.
I mean, he's a hog molly in every sense of the word. He's 6'7", 364 pounds. And the scary thing about it was that he ran a 5.140. When was the last time you heard anyone over 300 pounds running? He ran a 5.140-yard dash at 364 pounds. He is a massive human being. He's going to bolster that offensive line, which has gone over a complete rebuild under Jets GM Joe Douglas. Sitting on that at the left tackle position, he's going to be able to protect Sam Darnold. And so I thought it was a great pick for the Jets. It's the guy that I wanted. I actually didn't even think he was going to fall to the Jets, because there were four top offensive linemen. The Giants took one in Andrew Thomas out of Georgia. A little bit surprising at number four, because a lot of people, myself included, had Thomas as number four out of those four offensive linemen, but the Giants liked him. They took him with the number four pick overall. But Mekhi Becton really is just a mountain of a human being. I mean, I'm going to be very comfortable having him protect Sam Darnold for the next 8 to 10 seasons. I am, Lord willing, that happens, but I am very comfortable with this pick.
Absolutely. And you look, and Aaron, you said anybody that big, and listen, you and I, we've all known people, big 6-footers who are that big, but, you know, they can barely get out of a car. You look at his footwork and the way, and it's just, not only can he move, he's actually, for that size of a guy, he's almost light on his feet. It's amazing to see that.
Yeah, one of the big things about Becton was that, and you hear this with a lot of guys that are big, that have great footwork. He was a basketball star when he was in high school. I know that's a couple of years away from where he's at now, but that footwork doesn't really go away. To be able to get into his pass pro and be able to get into some of the things that he has to do on the football field, he's got to be able to move that big body of his. And he does it in a way that is really amazing and has him at this level in the draft, because picking at 11, that's, you know, high priority here. Offensive lineman third offensive lineman off the board. And he just, like I said, that footwork and the things that he's able to do on the football field physically on paper are special. Now, the question is going to be, is he going to be able to maintain that athleticism as he continues on in his career? Because, I mean, 364 pounds is a lot of weight to have to carry on. And if he's not disciplined with it, he might get a little bit out of shape here, and that's not going to help anybody.
Okay, now you mentioned the guy the Giants took. A lot of Giants fans in and around WICC in Fairfield County, going back 50, 60 years, some of them. Should they be happy with this guy?
It's funny because I was shocked that they took Andrew Thomas, like I said. Thomas is a good offensive lineman. Coming out of Georgia, he's played in a lot of big games down in the SEC, and he's a good offensive lineman. Was he the best available offensive lineman? I don't think so. I think they could have taken Jedrick Wise Jr. out of Alabama, Tristan Weiss out of Iowa. Weiss ended up going to the Buccaneers. Weiss Jr. ended up going to the Browns. So you have some guys that were there that maybe would have been better fit. The Giants need a lot of defensive help. They could have even taken Isaiah Simmons out of Clemson, who ended up going number 8th overall to the Cardinals. But it's not an awful pick. I was talking to a couple Giants fans that I hang out with in fantasy leagues and some of my family that are Giants fans, and they don't love the pick, but they also don't hate it. So it's kind of a rare territory that the Giants are in where they didn't love a pick. But Thomas, I think, is going to be solid for them. He's, like I said, I don't think he was the best available, but he's still a solid pick.
Okay, one of our bosses, a connoisseur, he actually roots for the New England Patriots. You know, you and I have to put up with that. And so I guess because Big Boss Keith might be listening, what did the Evil Empire do, and should the boss be happy, or are we going to be able to mock him for the Patriots draft?
Well, you say Evil Empire, and those are your words, not mine. I like my job. but actually, the Patriots were pretty quiet in the first round. They didn't have a pick. They traded it away. It was San Diego's, I believe, second pick. Yeah. But they took Kenneth Murray, the linebacker, out of Oklahoma. So the Patriots were quiet. You're going to see a lot more movement of them over the next couple of days. The biggest thing that came out of the draft, at least in my opinion, was the fact that Aaron Rodgers in Green Bay, that was the big thing everyone was talking about. The Packers took Jordan Love, the quarterback out of Utah State, with the 26th pick. Very eerily similar to what happened when Aaron Rodgers got drafted in for Brett Favre. And I laughed when I saw this pick right after the Jets at number 12. The Oakland Raiders took Henry Ruggs, the third wide receiver out of Alabama. This guy is stupid fast. He ran a 4.27 40, one of the fastest 40 times that we've ever seen. And as soon as I saw that pick, he was the first wide receiver off the board. All I could think about was the spirit of Al Davis is alive and well in Las Vegas.
Our weekly sports chat here that we do every Friday heading into the weekend, hadn't been too much sports, but Aaron Johnson joins us anyway. We rifted a little bit about the NFL draft. A little closer to home, Aaron, you may have seen it the other day where the CIAC, no surprise to you and I mean, they said, look, there's not going to be any spring sports championships. You know, you and I both know that. But it was interesting that they did say something about having a, you know, a spring sports or being able to have some sort of a sports experience. They talked about addressing that at their meeting coming up on May 7th. I don't know. What do you think? To me, that sounds like maybe some softball or baseball scrimmages. I mean, I don't know what they might mean by that.
Well, that's still, you know, yet to be determined, too, Paul. I'm not sure what they're going to do as far as what an experience actually means when it comes to playing a spring season. You got to feel for the kids in a lot of ways. The CIAC Board of Control had a meeting yesterday morning, and that is when they made the decision to get rid of all postseason tournaments and championships for the spring season. Now, it's really going to hinder on whether or not the schools are going to be able to open back up. Schools are right now supposed to be closed until May 20th. I know that's still a month away, but that just with everything that's going on, it's such a fluid situation. It's going to be hard to see if we actually have schools, you know, go back in session around that date. If a final decision is made, whether or not schools are going to be closed for the rest of the year, you can't expect them to play. They don't even think they'll be allowed to play any kind of sport. So the spring season would be completely just taken away if they don't go back to school, the students don't go back to school. So that's going to be the big sign to see whether or not they're going to be able to do anything. They got to get these kids back into the classrooms first, and they got to make sure that those classrooms are safe and that everyone that's going into these schools are going to be safe. And if there's no assurance to that, then sports, unfortunately, is going to have to get put on the back burner for the rest of the state.
Yeah, and you saw, too, a couple of things I guess they were looking at also in that meeting coming up on the 7th. One of the things you're going to look at is possibly, Aaron, possibly looking at altering transfer rules for kids who were going to move from school to school, altering the sit-out rules there. And also, nothing the CIAC really has control over, Aaron, but it's got to be so disappointing to some of these guys and gals who were looking forward to their senior season and now may not have a chance to put up some numbers that might get them a college scholarship somewhere.
I mean, I played in the CIAC when I was in high school 10 years ago, and I remember my senior season like the back of my hand. I remember so many different moments of it, and it really is disheartening. And this is going all the way back even into the winter sports, because if you remember, Paul, they canceled the winter state tournament right in the middle of the tournament. I mean, the girls' basketball tournament was, I believe, in the semifinal round, and they just and they had to cancel everything. And so for not only the winter, not only the spring sport athletes, but the winter sport athletes as well that didn't get, you know, the eyeballs or the game minutes that could propel them into a college career potentially, but also just to make those memories. Like I said, I played in the SWC 10 years ago, and I remember games I played. I remember played some games. I remember things my senior year that I know are going to stick with me the rest of my life, and it's really sad for some of these kids that aren't going to get an opportunity to have those memories. I mean, especially when you bust your tail for, you know, months leading up into the season for something that like this that's so unforeseen and so unprecedented to cost you that season potentially. It's something that, I mean, I really feel for the kids. I do.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, and it's, Aaron, in all seriousness, but really kind of tongue-in-cheek, it's not like, you know, you can be a fifth-year senior in college, you know, geez, I'll stay here for an extra year because I was injured or I couldn't play my senior year and, you know, start a grad degree in something. Last I checked, my friend, there are no five-year seniors in high school, I think. I'm pretty sure.
None that are playing sports, at least. Let's just put it that way.
All right, Aaron, listen, thanks, man. Always good to check in with you. Aaron Johnson, former producer of the program here, now works with Anna and Raven. The FM people are much better looking. That's why he's there. You don't have to look at me anymore. Star 99.9 in the morning. Aaron, be good, and we'll talk next week, all right?
Awesome, Paul. Thanks a lot. Take care.
I just wanted you to know that we just got out of our weekly video conference with Vice President Pence and the White House COVID Task Force. Sort of interesting how we line up compared to most of the states out there, like Connecticut, are seeing the hospitalizations going down and testing ramping up in a serious way. And that's what this first slide says. It's sort of consistent with what we've seen more or less over the last week or so. Deaths are continue to be high, lagging indicator. Hospitalizations, this is the biggest drop in hospitalizations that we've seen, and you know how important an indicator that is. Next slide. Again, you'll see that not only is Hartford, New Haven, but now also Hartford is, you know, flat and going down. In fact, Fairfield County is down about 13% since its peak. So that's extraordinary good news in terms of what that means to our future. Another way that we look at it, as you know, is from hospitalization statewide. Here you can see what the three-day moving average is. And you can see that trend line is trending down. And as you maybe remember from the White House task force, they had said 14 days of consistent downward trend, you're moving in this, what they call tier one. And tier one is pretty much where we are right now because we never closed down our parks and beaches. It gives the hospitals maybe a second look at thinking about elective surgeries. So this is where we could be in another week, assuming this trend line continues, which is so positive. We had an interesting conversation with the task force. Most of our fellow governors, like ourselves, are ramping up the testing. You know, we've done well just because of our relationships, as you know, with CVS and some of the other partners out there, Quest, of course, Thermo Fisher. One of the things that, you know, I pointed out is rather than over-relying upon the drive-through tests, we're making a big point of making sure those tests also get out into the community, especially the urban communities where people are a little less likely to be tested. You heard that with a Quest the other day, and you're going to hear a little more about our mobile van as we get more people tested, especially in underserved communities where people may be more likely to be infected and have serious consequences. All the governors had, we talked about the flare-ups. It's not a consistent straight line, and Obviously, as you look around the country, you see the New York metropolitan area going down. We're part of that. You certainly see Louisiana. You see Detroit. These are all good trend lines. But as I've said before, Boston is flaring up. Philadelphia is flaring up. So they're following this almost on a heat map that we get to see as you try and track what those trends are out there. All of our states have flare-ups in those more congested places, starting with nursing homes and correctional facilities. We've been pushing pretty hard on FEMA and the feds to help us out there, just like all the nursing homes are pushing us pretty hard to be helpful. FEMA is stepping up. Better late than never. They're going to have a big delivery to every single nursing home in the country, in all of our nursing homes, of more protective gear, and starting with the masks and gowns. And that starts shipping out on May 1st. It ought to be completed about 10 days thereafter. And that's on top of the incredible increase in a PPE that we've got, that we've been getting distributed to all of our nursing homes as well. And that's on top of the fact that we're going out doing physical inspections of these nursing homes. And Josh tells me about two-thirds of those homes have been inspected. And if there have to be corrections in terms of infectious or cleaning, we're ready to do that and have instructed them as such. I was a little surprised but not shocked to hear about another disruption because it impacts the food chain. And those are flare-ups in some of the compressed food processing places. You maybe heard about what happened in South Dakota. You know, they're the meatpacking. You know, almost all of the infections in South Dakota are in and around that meatpacking facility. Then we had the governors of Maryland, the governors of Virginia talk about a similar flare-up in poultry and on the farms there and the processing there. So makes you think a little bit about our food supply and the food chain out there, food supply chain. And it's something where I really like to see the federal government take the lead, because obviously we get food from all over the country, so does every other state, and having the logistics of that set up would be best done on a federal basis. But here in the state of Connecticut, we're going to take the lead in any way we can when it comes to food and food security in that supply chain. And I couldn't think of anybody better to take the lead on that than our Commissioner of Agriculture, Brian Hurlbut. Brian understands, A, what we can do for ourselves, and you know how important that is to me by way of philosophy. You know, we were just brokenhearted to see that our dairy farmers were pouring away unused milk because it's not as necessary in our restaurants and the such. Well, we're coming up with strategies now to be able to compensate the farmers, be better able to get that food, get the logistics, get the refrigeration, so it can be distributed not only in Rentschler Park with a food share and the hundreds of people lining up because they desperately need that food, but also some of our you know, farm to table and fairs that we'll have later on. And we're working closely with Deirdre Gifford, you know, our Department of Social Services, expanding SNAP, like food stamps, so that people will be able to go to our farm tables and be able to get fresh food and pay for it with SNAP. We're working closely with 4CT, which, as you know, is our philanthropic effort, where we've raised over $15 million, and see if they can help provide some of the legwork, support, and support for our farmers, just to keep that flow going. So thank you, Brian, for stepping up and helping us on this. Lisa Tepper-Bates, as well as helping us get the people power we need to make sure that this works in a real way. The other thing that Deirdre's working on in terms of that food supply chain is our restaurants. Find ways we can give them more activity. Right now, please call up your restaurant, and if they have, you know, knock and dash, if you can pick up, do pick up to give them extra support. And we're going to work with them any way we can to help them in terms of preparation of meals and delivery of meals. Working closely with DoorDash is one of Grubhub, a number of companies that can help with the delivery of meals to our seniors and those who are under quarantine. And I'm afraid this is probably going to go on for some time. So these are all facets of the food chain that we're trying to accelerate as best we can. Finally, with the White House Task Force, there was, you know, some congratulation about the supplemental 3.5, so to speak. It's, as you know, billions of dollars for the small business, so we can ramp that up, $300 billion to be exact. And again, that's going to be available, Paul's just told me, Monday, 10:30. That's when they'll take new grants for our new applications. And as you heard from Glenlyn Thames the other day, you know, work for, with your local bank, work with a community bank, go to PayPal and some of the electronic fintech companies. Those are ways that you can get to the front of the line. Connecticut did pretty well last time. We're going to do even better. I want all of our small businesses taken care of by what we're doing. Of the hospitals, $75 billion, $11 billion for testing. And we spent a lot of time with the fellow governors, what we're doing in terms of testing strategies. Phil Murphy, New Jersey, talking about the saliva test. A lot easier to self-administer, a lot quicker to be able to get that in the field. Probably has to be at the lab so we can get that out there. So we're making progress on that, and there'll be resources for that and resources for you know, track and trace. And other governors are using some of the state employees, using volunteers, using public health departments, and we're going to be rolling that out over the course of the next week or so. Finally, some frustration, again, from all the governors as regards support for hospitals, support for small businesses, support for airlines, but no support for state and local government, no support for the teachers and the firemen and the nurses and a lot of people who are on the front lines here in this COVID crisis. And I had the opportunity to point out to the vice president, this is not a traditional recession where income tax revenue goes down and then goes back up. That's what happened in the last recession, and we can prepare for that. We did prepare for that. But in this recession, it's not just income tax, but it's sales tax that has taken a big hit. And you know why. You saw the graphs from yesterday. That's restaurants and bars and hospitality. And that hits Connecticut, and it hits other states really hard. And there's some question how fast the hospitality is going to come back. And that's why we have to think about support from the federal government, us trimming our sales, being lean going forward, husbanding our rainy day fund to make sure we're there, you know, 6 months and a year from now in case we're not totally on the backside of the revenue cliff that we are facing here. You know, with that, I want to just give you good news and introduce you to two friends of mine who have just been invaluable. And first off is Kathy Szilard. Kathy is the CEO of Stanford Hospital. And I really wanted Kathy to be here for a couple of reasons. One, she has a close partnership with General Yvon and the Connecticut Guard and everything they've done to set up a field hospital there, which has given them the capacity to make sure that nobody gets left behind. We free up beds for the intermediate care and the such. And just as importantly, Kathy and Stanford Hospital have been early on in this. You know, maybe, just maybe, they're on the back side of the surge right now, and she can give you some good insights to other hospitals and folks around the state, what Stanford has learned from having been in this for well over a month now.
I had a caller earlier in the show. It was Don. In fact, I get calls like this all the time. Are we going to change how we do business with countries, in particular with China, when we get through this whole coronavirus situation? A lot of people saying it's time to bring not only manufacturing from China back to the U.S., but other areas as well. And it's not as easy as some people think. This started years and years ago. And to talk about that, we welcome to WICC Don Buckner, who founded MadeInAmerica.com and MadeInAmerica.org. Don, Paul here in Bridgeport on WICC. How are you?
Well, thank you so much for having me. We're down here in Central Florida. Sounds like we got about the same weather you do. It's cold and rainy.
Oh, man. Well, yeah, but what's cold down there, like 65 degrees?
No, probably 69.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I won't hold you. I won't pin you back for 4 degrees, Don. Don, you know, we've been discussing this in this country for years and years and years. You and I both know that America loves to shop by price, as consumers probably all around the world do, in the four corners of the world. But when companies decide they're going to compete with price, a lot of times it means they're not going to make stuff here. What made you get together and start MadeInAmerica.com and MadeInAmerica.org?
Good question. Started over 20 years ago, back in 1998. I saw 20 senior senators decided to retire. I mean, leadership. So they decided to walk away, and I said, something's wrong. Leadership doesn't walk away like that. And sure enough, at Christmas in 1998, they gave China temporary most favored trade status. Mm-hmm. So I started buying up some domains. Those two were some of them. I also bought madeinusa.com and madeintheusa.com. But anyway, what really topped it off was in 2000, President Clinton at the time, who enjoyed one of the most robust economies that this country's ever experienced. We were debt-free at that time, if you remember. Mm-hmm. And one of his last acts in 2000 was to give China permanent most favored trade status. So consequently, that was the beginning of the free trade experiment. And we can all look back and say that experiment was a failure. So those tariffs that went away because of that need to be reinstated. Those tariffs have been honed and worked on for over 50 years to be at the levels that allowed U.S. manufacturers to compete without tariffs. Those prices that you just talked about, you're exactly right. That has allowed us to become literally dope addicts, like a typical drug addict would be on those cheap made products. And so we have to wean ourselves off of that idea. There's two ways to change consumer behavior. One is to raise the tariffs, raise the prices of imported products. The other is through education. So this virus, if anything good comes from this virus, it's going to be an awakening that's happened with people waking up to the fact that China, we are beholden to China for our sovereignty. If for some reason, 6 months from now, they decided to not give us our clothes, 97% of them are not made here, our electronics are not made here, our medications are not made here, we would be sick, we'd be naked, and we'd be Neanderthals. So we are literally beholden to China and many other countries for our sovereignty, which is our independence, and is really, really sad. So the only way to change that is how we spend our money. So we have a really four-step plan, if I could share it with you,
sure,
of how this stimulus money has to be spent. The stimulus money can do one of two things. It can stimulate China's economy by going to Walmart and Amazon and spending that money and sending it to China, or we can spend it here. So if you've got a second, I'll share this plan with you. We call it four steps to economic recovery in 60 days.
Yeah, go ahead.
The first step is do not buy imported products. Pretty simple, huh? We don't want to enrich other countries with their dollars. Second step, shop local. That's not hard. Don't go online or a big box store, like I've already said, and buy Chinese-made products. When you shop local, you're keeping those dollars in the community, and sometimes that money will actually come back to you.
Mm-hmm.
Step three, buy only American-made products. Kind of an easy concept, but when you buy American-made products, those dollars stay in this country, providing pay for those manufacturers, their employees, and their suppliers, and all the people they spend their money with. So every time money changes hands, it creates wealth in this country. And then finally, number four is hold on to the money until the economy reopens. Wait until your gym, your restaurant, your salon opens and spend the money with them. So for the next 60 days, if we'll use our stimulus dollars wisely, we can accelerate the recovery and get our lives back to normal much sooner. So it's very basic, very simple.
Yeah.
And that's all on madeamerica.org. That's all on that website.
You know, Don, you and I can understand that. And I think a lot of people do understand that. But, I'm looking at my smartphone here, which is not made in the U.S. And, you know, like, for example, you and I both know that the vast, vast, vast majority of electronics and smartphones are made overseas. Now, and I saw a story in the Wall Street Journal probably about 3-4 years ago, said that, well, if you were to make, say, an Apple iPhone, and I'm guessing it'd be the same thing for a Samsung Galaxy or one of the Android phones, said, okay, well, if you make it in the U.S., you're going to add probably about $150 or $200 to, you know, the cost of the phone because of labor costs, at least initially. Do you think Americans would be okay with that, or are they just going to revolt?
So, the way to control that, it's all about comparison.
Mm-hmm.
So if you had a tariff on the imported phone, it'd be the same price.
Yeah.
In fact, the domestic product may even be cheaper. So the tariff is the leveler, which is a tax, which is we in the United States have to, as a manufacturer, you have to pay a fair wage, you have to pay insurance, you have to pay taxes. Mm-hmm. All these things are much, much higher overhead here. So if we want to continue in our American way of life, we have to pay more. That's just the way it is. And so somehow we've been lured into this trap of cheap products are going to benefit us. Well, that's not true. When that money leaves this country, those dollars that you spend on that phone leaves this country, those dollars aren't allowed to create wealth in this country. They don't change hands again and again and again. That's where real wealth is built in this country, is how those dollars change hands. So when it leaves, we're enriching our enemies. We're enriching people who don't like us. And we're sending that money, and does not come back. And so that's the real problem. I always say free trade is not free. The price is American jobs. And so we have to think further than just ourselves when we spend our money. And to be honest with you, we can only affect about 5% of the population. We know that. We're not trying to affect everybody.
It's a big chunk, though, when you talk about America being a country of 330 or 340 million people. 5 million, 5% of that is 17 million people. It ain't nothing to sneeze at. And we are here for a few more minutes talking about madeinamerica.org and madeinamerica.com. We continue with Don Buckner. Don, at the risk of letting people be home saying, well, this Buckner guy, he's just saying what everybody else says, Made in America. You do know from whence you speak here. You've got a pretty good background here in manufacturing and a company. Give us a little bit of your background here and why this hits hits home so close to you.
So developed a product, built several in my garage, literally, and grew the company over a period of time. We were very blessed. We grew to be somewhere around 100 employees, ultimately $50 million a year. Just very blessed, and recently sold that company to a $1 billion corporation, which was the end goal anyway. So manufacturing, we built it soup to nuts, started with bare steel and built the finished product. The company was Vactron, V-A-C-T-R-O-N, and sold that product, sold that company, sold it all over the world. Got a real lesson in hard knocks and how to grow a company, build a company, and manage a company, and then finally sell a company. So a manufacturing company, nonetheless. So we're very intimately involved with manufacturers. We fully understand the struggles they deal with because we've dealt with them firsthand.
And when you were branching out and selling these products all over the world, as you said, Don Buckner, I would assume you had a lot of eureka moments out there, oh my God moments. Like, I guess it was a kind of an on the job learning experience of making something is one thing, but getting it to markets and other parts of the globe is probably another, right?
So you're exactly right. So getting an idea, 80% of U.S. manufacturers are less than 50 employees. So that's the heart and soul of this country's manufacturing. So most of those people are very, very good at putting part A with part B and selling it as part C. Why Amazon has been so fruitful and been so beneficial is most of those companies have no understanding of how to market or distribute or fulfill their product. And so consequently, that's how Amazon got started. And sadly, Amazon is now taking those products and going overseas with them, just like Walmart did. And so it's a really sad situation that's happening there. So we have to really pay attention when we buy products, wherever we buy those products. The country of origin needs to be a primary consideration when we make that decision to purchase that product and spend our dollars on it, because our dollars are going to that company so they can pay their employees, pay their vendors. And I'm writing a book called Circle Economics, which indicates that the money goes in a circle. When you say money's in circulation, you're implying that money goes in a circle, and literally some of that money can wind up back with you if you spend it on an American-made product or an American service.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, finally, Don Buckner, what should we take out of all of this with the coronavirus and the fact that we now have these tensions with China, and we're actually seeing, which is kind of surprising, kind of a bipartisan call here in Congress to, you know, once this whole thing slows down a bit, to really reevaluate things that you say are important as to our business dealings, not only with China, but other countries around the world. What do you think we'll eventually get from that? You think it's going to be a lot of hot air this time around, or you think we may actually do something here?
Well, our prayer sure is that that something actually does happen and that this passion does not wane. We're learning a really tough lesson. It's sad that we're in the position that we're in, but it's not too late. Just because the house is on fire doesn't mean we don't put the garden hose on it and start trying to put it out. So we are working as hard as we can trying to convince consumers that they need to spend their stimulus money, particularly right now. Mm-hmm. We determined that about 90% of that stimulus money is disposable income when you add up the people that are still working, those on Social Security, those on welfare, and those on disability. That's over 200 million people whose incomes were not affected. And that's $200 billion that's going to be disposable income. And it's how they spend that $200 billion over and over and over in this country or sending it to China that's going to make the difference in how we recover economically.
Well, Don, thank you. Keep ringing the bell on this. I think it's important to at least consider and discuss. Check it out, madeinamerica.com or madeinamerica.org. The guest, Don Buckner. Hey, Don, thanks. We appreciate it. Stay safe, and hopefully we can talk down the line. Thanks, Don.
My pleasure.